This is July 13th, 2008, and today for Teishu, I'm going to report on my week in Chautauqua and comment on it from Zen perspective. I have this, I suppose, something of a compulsion about sharing books and articles, and also it was such a rewarding, positive experience for me that I just couldn't, for this first Sunday after my time there, not recount some of the some of what I got out of there. This is my second full week of teaching there at the Chautauqua Institution. A few years ago, Mala Sensei and I went down just for a weekend. And let me tell you about the Chautauqua Institution. Many of you know about it, but it's a venerable old educational center alongside Chautauqua Lake in southwestern New York State. It's just 5 miles, I'm told, 5 miles from the Ohio border in the extreme southwestern corner of western New York, about 2.5 hours from here. 783 acres. It's basically a gated community. You have to get a pass to enter. It's not cheap, and they have a 9-week season. It's just in the summer, and each week has a different theme. I'm reading here from their own little blurb. On any day during this summer season, there are approximately 7,500 people in residence there. This was founded in 1874. The first 100 years or so, it was primarily a Christian Protestant institution, and then it opened up to now include other faiths. I was invited again this year to teach as part of what they call their Mystic Heart Program, which is a ecumenical program where each week they have a different meditation teacher leading morning meditation and giving afternoon talks. Actually, the week before me, there was another Zen person, not a teacher, but another Zen person leading, doing that, filling that role, and then we had two weeks in a row where it was Zen. It says here, by 1880, the Chautauqua Platform had established itself as a national forum for open discussions of public issues, international relations, literature, and science. They have their own symphony orchestra, their own ballet company, their own opera company, and these companies perform in the amphitheater, which is a 5,000-seat outdoor amphitheater. So that's the Chautauqua Institution, and my role was I was asked to lead morning meditation from 7:15 to 8 each day, and then on two afternoons during the week to give an hour and a half talk about Zen. So that's the outline, and this week that I was there, I went with Christopher as my assistant. The theme was writing, in particular creative writing. And the main forum for that, the most the headliners in that were spoke at a morning lecture, at one each day, and they were the following writers. The first Monday was Billy Collins, the poet laureate. The next three mornings in this order were E.L. Doctorow, Joyce Carol Oates and Amy Tan, and then on the last day was Gary Trudeau. And I was just struck as the week went on, especially at how each one of them, most of them anyway, how they talked about the creative process. And I was struck by how similar it was to this work that we are doing, this spiritual work, the Zazen. And that's what I want to talk about. Billy Collins, I didn't know him by name, even though I remember reading two of his poems at different times in Taisho. And those were two of the poems that he read from the podium. And I printed them out this morning, and I want to read them again because they're just so wonderful, these poems. One is called Dharma. And that's the name of his dog. And here's how it goes. The way the dog trots out the front door every morning without a hat or an umbrella, without any money or the keys to her doghouse, never fails to fill the saucer of my heart with milky admiration. Who provides a finer example of a life without encumbrance? Thoreau in his curtainless hut with a single plate, a single spoon? Gandhi with his staff and his holy diapers? Off she goes into the material world with nothing but her brown coat and her modest blue collar, following only her wet nose, the twin portals of her steady breathing, followed only by the plume of her tail. If only she did not shove the cat aside every morning and eat all his food. What a model of self-containment she would be. What a paragon of earthly detachment. If only she were not so eager for a rub behind the ears, so acrobatic in her welcomes. If only I were not her God. He had the crowd eating out of the palm of his hand. He was just a remarkable person and with remarkable poetry. He's, I think, the only one who got a standing. No, not the only one, but he. One of two, I think, who got a full rousing standing ovation from 5,000 people afterward. He at one point said that poetry has now become something of a craze, but it's become exclusively about the poet. I seem to be saying it's too centered on celebrity, like so much else in our society. He quoted the poet Shelley as saying, "We must learn to imagine what we know." There, I right away thought of our enlightened nature that we all have in common, and how even though we all have it in common, it's another thing altogether to come to the awareness, the possibility, the aspiration to enlightenment, bodhicitta. The world is peopled with enlightened beings, but how many ever conceive of the possibility of awakening to that essential nature, that enlightened nature? We must learn to imagine what we know. One other poem that he read and that I read years ago here called Forgetfulness. The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of. As if, one by one, the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago, you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye and watched the quadratic equation pack its bag. And even now, as you memorize the order of the planets, something else is slipping away. A state flower, perhaps. The address of an uncle. The capital of Paraguay. Whatever it is you are struggling to remember, it is not poised on the tip of your tongue, not even lurking in some obscure corner of your spleen. It has floated away down a dark mythological river whose name begins with an L, as far as you can recall. Well on your own way to oblivion, where you will join those who have even forgotten how to swim and how to ride a bicycle. No wonder you rise in the middle of the night to look up the date of a famous battle in a book on war. No wonder the moon in the window seems to have drifted out of a love poem that you used to know by heart. I heard so many people echo my own feeling after that lecture, which is, I've got to get back into poetry. I have to read more poetry. And this is the genius of poetry, or of any art, of course, but, and that is to plug us into something beyond this ordinary mind. And in doing so, the best of it will attune us to that which we have in common. What Xuang Tzu said, this indivisible, which is always behind the divisible. I'm going to move on to the lecturer of the second day. Oh, by the way, in an afternoon lecture, which was a smaller forum, Jeffrey Toobin, the CNN legal analyst, gave a talk on the Supreme Court and the desperate importance of the presidential, the next president, who the next president is in terms of whom will be appointed to the Supreme Court, where, he said, there are four of the most liberal justices, and plus one or two others, who are getting very much advanced in age, in the 70s and 80s. That was also a fascinating lecture. But then E.L. Doctorow, well-known novelist, he wrote Billy Bathgate. He wrote, what else did he write?
Ragtime.
Thank you. All right. Okay. So he mentioned all these, but I somehow forgot them. he was quite an impressive guy. The Book of Daniel, another novel of his. It's often called a historical novel, but he challenged that very term. He said, aren't all novels historical? Aren't they all based on something of our past? In that book, he said, he sat down and wrote 150 pages, and then reread it, found it boring, and had to change the voice. All three novelists spoke about the voice, about finding your voice in your writing, the voice of the characters. And he had it in the third person, and he wanted to change it. He then changed it to the first person. But he said, I had to slog through those first pages, those first 150 pages, to find the character, to find the voice. And doesn't that resonate with long Zen practice? All of the false voices we have to slog through, sometimes for years, sometimes for decades, before we find this true voice, our own voice that is a no voice, the voice of the rain, the crows, our own laughter, our own weeping. The most memorable statement of his there in his lecture is one that I already had written down years ago and used in a Tay show a few years ago. He said, writing a novel is like driving a car at night. You can only see as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole journey that way. And this is really the nature of practice, true practice, Zazen, is really not knowing where we're going. Or as Saint Meister Eckhart put it, going I know not where by a road I know not of. A couple days later, Amy Tan said, regarding this analogy, driving a car at night and you can only see as far as your headlights, she said, for me, it's like driving a bicycle and only seeing as far as that one headlight of the bicycle. There's a koan in the Shoyo Roku, the Book of Serenity, one of the main collections of koans, where a Chinese master, Di Zhang, asked the great Fei Yan, this is when Fei Yan apparently was still struggling, still a young monk, he asked him, where are you going? Fei Yan said, I am wandering aimlessly. Di Zhang, what do you think of wandering? Fei Yan, I don't know. Di Zhang, not knowing is most intimate. And at that, Fei Yan was suddenly enlightened. In a way, this is what practice all comes down to. All right, there are various ways of sort of summing up or encapsulating Zen practice, Zen teaching, but this is definitely one of the best, if not the best, and that is it's all intended to bring us to a state of non-abiding, not clinging, not knowing. Because so long as we are clinging to anything we've learned, any of the conditioning we've picked up, the concepts, the notions of our education, our socialization process, then we still are in a state of knowing. To some degree, we're still operating out of a sense of knowing. This is the way things are. This is the way she is. He is such and such a person. They are. Muslims are such and such. Women are, men are. It's just notions, concepts. In Zazen, we're trying to flush out these notions and concepts and just respond to things, people, individuals, in the moment, out of the moment. And that is where we find intimacy with the moment. With this, just this. Sound of the car. Not thoughts about the car. The thing itself. This is the essence of Zen. The direct experience. Dr. O said something quite similar to what I just read of Billy Collins, or rather Shelley. Billy Collins quoting Shelley, saying, "We must learn to live what we know. We must learn to imagine what we know." And Dr. O said, actually quoting him, himself, quoting someone else, "Children learn language in order to tell the stories that are already in them." That would be us as well. We were all. Someone once said, lawyers, I suppose, were children once. The next day was Joyce Carol Oates. One of the format of this of each of these lectures, this, and they were attended by pretty much 5,000 people. It was just pretty much every seat taken in this amphitheater. The format was that each of these five well-known authors were interviewed somewhat by Roger Rosenblatt, who is a very extremely impressive, brilliant, a man of letters himself, written books in Time Magazine, U.S. Editor, commentator, columnist. He himself has lectured at Chautauqua 9 times. And he would somewhat provocatively quote, each after the first day, he would quote one of the preceding authors and see what that author sitting in front of him thought of that. And the first two authors had talked about this sort of groping their way in writing, groping their way in the dark, as we do in Zazen. If we're doing Zazen at its best, we really are groping. As St. John of the Cross said, if one wishes to be sure of the road he treads on, he must close his eyes and walk in the dark. But then Joyce Carol Oates, who has written 70 books, way more than I've written, she said, I really question what Billy Collins said about just groping your way through it. She said, and I'm sure this is true, she said, there are two ways of writing. She said, to see what you've done by doing it, and then, or to plan your book. She insisted that, especially with her murder mysteries, you have to have an ending in mind. You at least, if not the readers, have to know how it ends. And it reminded me a little bit, this may sound like a leap, but somehow it connected with the sense of Zazen. Doing Zazen as a means to an end of enlightenment or compassion or whatever, or just doing it as an end in itself. It's two ways of looking at it, really. And doing it as a means to an end can work up to a point. But what that implies is that there is some subtle notion in the mind of getting something out of it, a goal. Or if not, that it somehow can be a functional value, this Zazen, and certainly it can. And it can have value even in the writing process. And I know this from my own experience. It's where if I find myself writing an article and I find myself kind of jammed up at some point, not knowing exactly where I'm going. I remember Roshi Kaplow, when I worked on him with his books, at some point he would, in the same point where he got kind of stymied, he would sit down and look out and more to himself than to me, he would say, what is it we're trying to say here? What is it we're trying to say? Oh, writers know this. This is doesn't have to be consciously articulated. It's just we get to points where we just have to stop ourselves and look more closely at what we're doing, what we're trying to say. This is why writing is such a great way of clarifying our thinking. And so for myself, I find that when I'm at home and writing and feel that I'm sort of snarled up in words and thoughts, I will sometimes sit, just cross my legs, with or without a pad of paper next to me, and just let it all settle. Let the thoughts settle. It's a bit like working on a koan, one of the subsequent koans, not one's first koan, that's a little different. But working on subsequent koans where you have to sort of weave your way through the words to the what the words come out of, the spirit behind it. And while sitting, it's amazing how quickly, maybe quickly for me because I've been doing this my whole life, the sitting, but I don't know, maybe for others too, it would be fairly quick. How quickly the sitting, even without concentrating on the passages you're writing, just the sitting alone will clarify the direction to go, the next step, or how to pull all this together. Or insights can bubble up, insights about what you're writing, even if you're not explicitly concentrating on the content of your writing, because it's there, it's working in the mind, the writing. And sitting is just a way to clear out some of the debris that's getting in the way. So Zazen has that function of cleaning out the residue that obstructs optimal functioning of the mind. It's like cleaning out the leaves or the clippings that have got clogged up in the mower, or the sludge in the plumbing, the dust from an air filter in your car. This is Zazen. We're blowing out what is not necessary and what simply gums up the works. And so doing Zazen definitely can help us think more clearly and proceed with greater clarity as to whatever we're doing with this discriminating mind. Too often people think that Zen has some quarrel with the intellect or the discriminating mind. It's somehow bad. It's not true. It's when we don't need it. It's when we're doing simple activities that are diminished by thinking, such as eating an apple, walking through the rain, listening to music. We don't need to employ our discursive mind during these times. We certainly don't necessarily need to think of the past or the future. So then there are many times that we don't need to engage this discriminating mind. And when we don't, if we can simply shovel the snow, if we can simply play with our children at that moment, then it's those activities are so richly enhanced by being free of thoughts. But then, of course, there are times when we need to, and certainly writing is one of those times. It's working with words and concepts. And at such times, then Zazen can be a way to write and think more effectively. I always feel it's almost like cheating, you know, when to sit down, cross your legs, and in 10 or 15 minutes, these connections are made that had eluded me. Things have opened up. Things open up and reveal themselves. But this is using Zazen as a means to an end. It's Zazen in order to. It's second best to just the sitting for its own sake, without any goal, agenda, any problem solving. This is the real essential practice of Zen. Most of you have heard this famous story of the great Chinese master, two great Chinese masters, who went on to become Chinese masters, but one of them is still a monk, and the master, I forget his name, and the student is Basso or Matsu, or maybe he's the master. Anyway, these two guys, one is a master, and he sees his student sitting day and night, and he can see that there is an attachment there to Zazen as a means to an end. So he says, "What are you doing all this sitting day and night?" And the student said, "I'm sitting in order to become a Buddha." And the master said, "Really?" And then the master picks up a tile and begins polishing this tile, like a roof tile. Let's make it anything, a rock. And the student watches him for a while and then says, "What are you doing?" And the master said, I'm polishing this tile so it can become a mirror. And the student says, you can't polish a tile and have it become a mirror. And then the master said, and you can't become a Buddha by sitting. Now, Roshi Kaplow mentions this in his Three Pillars of Zen as grievously misunderstood by Alan Watts in one of his books, where Watts interprets this as saying, there's no point in doing Zazen. No, that's not the point. The master was saying, you can't become what you already are. So long as you're sitting with a goal, you're trying to get from point A to point B, from this state of delusion to a state of enlightenment. So long as that notion is in your mind, you're lost. We have to let it all go when we're sitting. And then the next day, Wednesday, was Amy Tan. And here too, I found myself just intrigued by the similarity of this creative writing with the process of Zen practice. She, like the ones before her, talked about writing for her. It was like receiving a gift from somewhere. From something else. In Zen, we would say that this something is nothing, a no-thing. It is through our sitting, our letting go of thoughts and all the contents of the mind, that we open up this channel to the realm of no-thingness, which is half of reality. It's a realm of what philosophers have called the noumenon, standing in distinction from phenomena. There's phenomena, that's everything we can possibly imagine. Physical things, ideas, thoughts, emotions, feelings, objects, and then there is this realm of the formless. Awakening is, genuine awakening is seeing these two as not two. Seeing, in other words, that in form there is only emptiness, form is only emptiness, emptiness is only form. Even in Buddhism, what is often called the void, this realm of no-thingness, the eternal, is sometimes referred to as the womb of phenomena, the creative void. Again, this where you can kickstart your creativity by dropping everything, even the wish to be more creative, just drop it all, and then we can find this natural movement out of nothing into something. You know the famous exchange where they asked Sir Edmund Hillary, after he climbed Mount Everest, why do you climb mountains? And he said, because they're there. years later, someone asked a writer, a famous writer, why do you write? And he said, because it isn't there. Amy Tan was laughing about how her mother, who was born in China, had this idea that Amy, in her writing, was getting it from her grandmother. Amy said it's like she, Amy Tan, was sitting at a keyboard and just sort of taking dictation from her grandmother. And then that resulted in, led into a discussion of ghosts or visions. Are they real or unreal? There's a lot, she spoke of this. The Chinese have a lot of interest in, if you can make a wild generalization, at least in Zen texts, there's more in the Chinese tradition regarding the supernatural, ghosts and supernatural things, than I've seen in the Japanese anyway. So are there ghosts? Do ghosts exist? Are they real? I think it's a wrong question. It's sort of irrelevant. Everything, the Buddhist teaching is that everything is mental formations. We create our world. Everything is mind. I tend to not disbelieve anything. Don't necessarily believe in most things, but nor disbelieve. When I was still going to Sweden, we heard about a hotel a few hours north of Stockholm that was reputed to be haunted with ghosts, and they actually capitalized on that, and they offered a certificate to anyone who could stay there the whole night. And of course they drew plenty of guests who wanted to take this on, including those guests included three of our members, Sante Sensei and Kanya Sensei. This is before they were Zen teachers. They went up there with Lisa Bruzzoni, and they did spend the night. Sante just slept through the whole night. Kanya and Lisa did say that they saw this figure at the foot of their bed, and they both, you know, looked the same to them. And these are not wacko women. They had never reported seeing ghosts before, and they never experienced it before. But they said very, very soberly that they sure saw something. But okay, so what? So there, okay, you see a form. Yeah, of course. I mean, it can be frightening, I suppose. But the question of whether it's real or unreal. And then the last day, Friday, was Gary Trudeau, the cartoonist who does Doonesbury. I was really, really struck by what a sensitive and deeply sympathetic person he is. I never realized it. His cartoons can, most of them don't make me laugh. I don't find them funny, but I always read them in the Sunday paper because there's a lot behind them. I was really struck by, he talked mostly about how his cartoon strip has brought in the Iraq, well, first the Vietnam War, that's where, when he was in college, but now, then later, the first Gulf War, and now the current Iraq War. And I was very touched by what a deep feeling of sympathy and respect he has for our soldiers there. He told some fascinating stories of being there in Iraq with the soldiers. Working with soldiers who've suffered from physical and psychological trauma, PTSD. He told us about how 30% of women in the military have suffered from either rape or sexual abuse, or what is called command rape. Command rape, we learned from him, is it's not a physically coercive, forced rape, but it is where the commander will say, "Come to my tent tonight," or "You're going out on this terribly risky mission the next day," or some kind of a threat like that. He really feels a great deal of sympathy for them and for their courage and their commitment. There was no time for questions at the end of his talk. The others, there were 10 or 15 minutes of questions where several of the 5,000 people could have their questions read. I would have wanted to ask him, I still would like to ask him, "All right, it's very commendable the kind of respect and you have for the commitment and the courage and of these soldiers and their protectiveness." He emphasized that soldiers are trained to want to protect one another and protect others. And that is the honor part of the military code. I would have wanted to ask him, "Can you see another side to all this? The side where these were men and women who volunteered to join the military and most of them placed themselves in a position where they'd have to kill other human beings." I think we can sacrifice our vision, our holistic understanding of soldiers, if we glorify them, if we see them only in idealized way, or the opposite, if we see them only with hate or contempt, the way so many of us regarded the soldiers in Vietnam when they returned. I think seeing the whole person is to recognize that it's not all about honor and protectiveness and courage. There are other aspects that are not as noble. I will read his cartoon strips with a whole new eye after seeing him speak with such feeling and sincerity about the plight of those in Iraq. Well, it seems like a natural point to stop. Last year, I was not sure that I wanted to return this year. It's hard when I have so much to do here, so many responsibilities. It's a little hard to justify going down there for a week and giving morning meditation to 30 or 35 people who then we never saw again after that week, never came up here to the center. But this year, there was much more of a response. We had each morning for morning meditation, we had 45 to 60 people, much more, many more people, partly I'm told because of the it was a better week. It was week number three of the season rather than the last week of the season when things are kind of frittering away. It was also a very gratifying response to my afternoon talks. The first one was 45 people. The second one was 64, standing room only. And now I feel that if they invite me back next year, I will go. Well, they already have, I guess. I heard secondhand that they want me to come back, and I will go back then next year for a week. Next year I won't be going to the Zen teachers meeting. I don't like to do that every year, and won't be going to a conference as I did this year, the Mind and Life Institute event. All right, let's wrap this up, and I will stop now and recite the four vows.